Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents All Our Trials, Prisons, Policing, and the Feminist Fight to End Violence by Emily L. Thuma, narrated by Erica Kane. Introduction. Washington, D.C.'s first ever march to stop violence against women kicked off just after dusk on April 29, 1978. A boisterous crowd of roughly 800 people, diverse in age, race, class, gender, and sexual identity, snaked through the city's adjacent neighborhoods of Adams Morgan and DuPont Circle. The marchers carried flashlights, whistles, and handmade signs, and their chants articulated the event's central message of, quote, self-determination for women, power for women, and self-defense for women. An extensive list of principles and demands drawn up by the organizers advocated community sanction for rape and abuse and solutions, quote, involving empowerment of women, education of men, and community action, rather than criminal justice. The demonstration represented a coalitional effort between three organizations: the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, the Task Force on Abused Women of the Women's Legal Defense Fund, and the, quote, open membership, action-oriented D.C. Area Feminist Alliance. More than 60 other local groups endorsed the statement of principles and demands. The march was the culmination of the city's first annual Anti-Rape Week, a community education project organized by the Black feminist leadership of the Rape Crisis Center. Once gathered at DuPont Circle Park, the demonstrators listened to an array of speakers and musicians. Among them was Linda Leakes, who delivered, quote, revolutionary greetings from Desi Woods, a Black woman serving a 22-year prison sentence in the state of Georgia for killing an armed white man who had attempted to rape her and her friend. Leakes, a local member of Woods' National Defense Committee, told the crowd that the incarcerated woman's story belonged to a long legacy of white men's sexual violence against Black women that was rooted in chattel slavery. Just a month earlier, Rape Crisis Center staff members Deirdre Wright and Nkinji Touré had traveled to the Georgia Women's Institute of Corrections to interview Woods as part of the center's work to help disseminate her story and urge feminists and other progressive people to take action on her behalf. To the organizers of the march, Woods' case and others like it exemplified the need for a feminist anti-violence agenda that took seriously to the perilous entwinement of racism, classism, and sexism in the criminal legal system. All Our Trials, Prisons, Policing, and the Feminist Fight to End Violence is a history of activism by, for, and about incarcerated domestic violence survivors, criminalized rape resistors, and dissident women prisoners in the 1970s and early 1980s. Across the United States, in and outside of prisons, grassroots women activists participated in collective actions that illuminated the interconnections between interpersonal violence against women and the racial and gender violence of policing and imprisonment. These mobilizations were spearheaded by radical women of color and anti-racist white women, many of them lesbian identified. They cultivated a distinctive left anti-violence politics that was defined by a critique of state violence, an understanding of race, gender, class, and sexuality as mutually constructed systems of power and meaning, and a practice of coalition-based organizing. This book traces the political activities and ideas that constituted this anti-carceral feminism and demonstrates that it shaped broader debates about the root causes of and remedies for violence against women. It also reveals the important role of this activist current in the making of a prison abolition movement in the 1970s. Anti-carceral feminist politics grew in the cracks of prison walls and at the interfaces between numerous social movements, including those for racial and economic justice, prisoners and psychiatric patients' rights, and gender and sexual liberation. Though the process of building coalitions that transected those social justice struggles, the activists at the center of this study produced a broad and layered understanding of violence against women that encompassed the structural violence of social inequalities, the violence of state institutions and agents, and interpersonal forms of violence, including rape, battering, and sexual coercion. This expansive analysis directly clashed with the tough-on-crime ethos of the 1970s, and the mainstream women's movement's increasing embrace of criminalization as a frontline solution to interpersonal violence. As this history demonstrates, violence against women was, as it still is, a highly charged political claim rather than a transparent descriptor. And the ascendancy of a law and order feminism was a deeply contested process. All Our Trials tells a story of resistance to violent policing and state repression of gender and sexual deviance and nonconformity. The chapters chronicle a series of organizing efforts forged by and in alliance with women whose social locations and practices place them beyond the pale of dominant notions of feminine respectability and state protection, and in the way of state harm. Those who were Black, Indigenous, Latina, immigrant, poor, gender and sexual outsiders, labeled crazy or mad, or involved in the sex trade. Feminist coalitions that foregrounded criminalized and incarcerated women produced new knowledges. They analyzed the interrelationship of state abandonment and state violence in communities of color, the entanglements of carceral and psychiatric power, and the racial constitution of gender and sexual norms and their brutal modes of enforcement in locked institutions. As the veteran Black feminist organizer Linda Burnham reminds us, quote, "The struggle for social transformation is a powerful generator of theoretical insight, as it affords opportunities for, quote, collective, mass-based inquiry. Although this book focuses on activist formations and the theoretical understandings they engendered, it also documents numerous examples of individual marginalized women's, particularly Black women's, bodily confrontations with institutional and interpersonal violence. From fighting back against a sexual attacker, to refusing to comply with a dehumanizing prison policy, to inscribing a testimony of personal violation in a radical prison newspaper. These everyday acts of survival helped constitute anti-carceral feminist thought and practice. This book, then, aims to offer a history of the carceral state from below. It recovers the political and theoretical contributions of grassroots activists who enacted solidarities across prison walls and seemingly discrete trials and struggles in their attempts to envision and create a violence-free world. As the upcoming chapters convey, this work was often arduous, and its results were uneven and messy. With varying degrees of success, activists strove to build coalitions that recognized rather than obscured differences of social power among women and centered those most vulnerable to the brutal and sometimes lethal nexus of interpersonal and state violence. In doing so, they put an intersectional analysis of structures of inequality and domination into practice. Critical race theorist Kimberly Crenshaw coined the term intersectionality in the late 1980s to theorize the imbrication of racial and gender inequality in Black women's lives and the incapacity of anti-discrimination law to address their multidimensional claims of employment discrimination. Yet, as scholars and activists have pointed out, the larger theoretical insight that systems of racial, gender, economic, and sexual oppression are inextricably linked, or, quote, interlocking, has a long and collective history that includes Black feminist and women of color feminist political organizing in the 1960s and 1970s. All Our Trials demonstrates how anti-violence mobilizations that focused on the lives of marginalized women were generative of an interwoven analysis of racism, sexism, heterosexism, and capitalism that pointed to the carceral state as a source of further harm rather than safety and redress. Over the last 5 decades, the U.S. carceral state has expanded dramatically, as is increasingly common knowledge. The country incarcerates a greater proportion of its populace than any other nation in the world. As of 2018, it confines nearly 2.3 million people in federal, state, military, and territorial prisons, local jails, juvenile jails, and reservation jails, immigrant detention centers, and state-run psychiatric hospitals and civil commitment centers. And it exerts control over the itineraries and behaviors of another 5 million people on parole or probation. While the number of people in women's prisons and jails continues to represent only a fraction of the incarcerated population, the rate of women's incarceration is more than octupled since the overall rate began to climb in the early 1970s. Black, Latinx, and indigenous communities are disproportionately represented throughout the country's vast system of lockups, and hence disproportionately affected by the myriad social, political, and economic consequences of the mass incarceration crisis. Much scholarly and public attention has been devoted to grasping the multi-layered political and economic roots of this massive prison boom. Whereas some scholars point to the Reagan administration's war on drugs as the principal engine, others look further back, to the pivotal moment of the 1960s war on crime. In 1965, amid black urban uprisings and insurgency in the context of the Civil and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 to 1965, and President Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society platform, Congress passed the Law Enforcement Assistance Act, which made local law enforcement a federal and increasingly militarized affair. 3 years later, the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Street Acts authorized the creation of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEAA, within the Department of Justice. It quickly grew into a sprawling federal agency and the new infrastructural backbone of the new anti-crime initiative. Under the tenets of restoring law and order and modernizing policing, the LEAA's principal function was granting millions of dollars to states each year to update and expand police weaponry, hire and train new personnel, and facilitate communication and coordination among local, state, and federal law enforcement. The LEAA played a decisive role in the buildup of carceral state power in the late 1960s and across the 1970s. Most acutely exercised in low-income, urban black communities by shaping, seeding, and subsidizing tens of thousands of local and state-level crime control initiatives. These involved a diverse array of state agents, quote, the police, sheriffs, and marshals responsible for law enforcement, the judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers that facilitate the judicial process, and the prison officials and probation and parole officers charged with handling convicted felons. Just on the heels of unprecedented civil rights legislation intended to dismantle Jim Crow, forms of racial exclusion and stratification, the racial state's capacity to surveil, police, and imprison swelled to new proportions. This immense influx of resources directly aided police and indirectly aided the FBI in criminalizing radical social movements in general, and the Black Power movement in particular. As critical geographer Ruth Wilson Gilmore writes, the disorder that became crime had particular urban and racial qualities, and the collective characteristics of activists, whose relative visibility as enemies inversely reflected their structural powerlessness, defined the face of the individual criminal. By the late 1960s, anti-racist, New Left, feminist, and gay liberation movements to varying degrees joined ranks with increasing frequency in expressions of solidarity. In response to this burgeoning opposition to the existing social order and with the direct aid of local law enforcement, the FBI expanded its existing counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, and set out to neutralize these movements. Pervasive surveillance of organizations and individuals was the foundation for a barrage of tactics designed to disorganize groups from within, as well as to weaken their external appeal and credibility. These methods included leaking false information to the press, fabricating evidence for criminal prosecutions, planting infiltrators to act as provocateurs, and even facilitating the assassinations of dozens of activists. Though certainly not the sole cause of factional conflict and disarray among radicals, this campaign succeeded in demonizing the left, especially black activists. It generated thousands of arrests and produced hundreds of women and men political prisoners, dozens of whom remain in prison today. This intense and targeted state-organized repression helped to make incarceration a core issue for the left. Communication and contact across prison walls increased, helping to spark the emergence of a radical prison movement. The precipitous growth of carceral state capacity not only placed more police in urban communities of color and aided in the repression of Black and other radical activists, but it also created new political opportunities for the feminist, anti-rape, and battered women's movements that emerged in the early 1970s. Feminist efforts to politicize rape and abuse galvanized a multitude of local programs. By the middle of the decade, more than 500 feminist-run rape crisis centers and refuges for abused women had been established throughout the country. These grassroots projects typically offered a combination of peer-based counseling, support groups, hotlines, and shelter. Some included self-defense classes and community education programs. All embraced a philosophy of radical self-help and mutual aid, and many include staff who self-identified as rape survivors and formerly battered women. The resources needed to provide around-the-clock shelter and other forms of crisis support led many activists to pursue government funding, and one of the most readily available sources was the LEAA. Feminists who built these institutions from the ground up weighed the possibilities and contradictions of relying on criminal justice funds to keep their doors open. Some advocates evinced a fundamental mistrust of law enforcement and pointed to persistent patterns of institutional racism and the repression of left-wing social movements. Most were concerned about the potential for such a relationship to undermine values and strategies that they had fought to prioritize, such as survivor self-determination, layperson expertise, and the participatory decision-making structures. And those working to amend rape and domestic violence laws questioned the strategic value of developing a client relationship with the state as they sought to reform the police and courts. Police and prosecutors often dismissed accusations of rape and battering, blamed victims for inviting assault by dressing or acting provocatively, exposed women's entire sexual histories to public scrutiny to degrade their credibility, avoided domestic disturbance calls, and, as was the case with Desi Woods, prosecuted women who used violence in self-defense. Scholars have argued that feminist movements contributed to the making of mass incarceration through support for Get Tough policies, making in response to rape and domestic violence. Feminist advocacy efforts in the 1970s helped to put sexual and domestic violence on the national crime control agenda by advocating more punitive responses, such as preferred and mandatory arrest policies and stiffer sentencing, and by narrowly framing domestic violence as a social problem that could be most effectively addressed by granting battered women, quote, the protection afforded to other victims of crime. Sociologist Beth Ritchie points to the significance of the anti-violence movement's early rhetoric of it can happen to any woman, what she and others refer to as the every woman construction to this process of state incorporation. Grassroots activists initially developed this formulation to make plain that rape and battering were pervasive cultural phenomena and not matters of individual pathology. By deploying it, they sought to debunk racist, classist, and imperialist stereotypes that such violence was inherent in and confined to particular races, classes, or nations. Yet as feminists, quote, won the mainstream but lost the movement between the 1970s and 1990s, as Ritchie puts it, this construction inadvertently took on a new valence. It can even happen to white, middle-class, gender and sexual conforming women, and help to reroute resources and energies into improving law enforcement and judicial interventions and away from a community organization approach. The passage of the 1994 Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, is perhaps the starkest example of how the claim to crack down on individual perpetrators of violence against women became a critical lever of legitimacy for expanding the carceral state. The new law earmarked unprecedented federal funding for improving the prosecution of sexual and domestic violence, as well as providing services for victims. Yet VAWA is just one component of the largest crime bill in U.S. history. The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act allocated nearly $10 billion for new prison construction, put 100,000 more police officers on the street, applied the three strikes and you're out rule to a variety of federal crimes, and terminated government funding for prisoners to pursue post-secondary education. Hence, an act promising to curb violence against women simultaneously authorized the expansion of institutional violence against the nation-state's racial and economic others, including many victims of domestic and sexual violence. All our trials complements and extends these indispensable accounts of the making of carceral feminism by demonstrating that, in tandem and in tension with feminist advocacy for criminal justice-based approaches to rape and battering, activists also explicitly challenged criminalization and explored non-statist approaches. It offers an alternate history of feminism and the carceral state by shifting the focus to spaces and places at the edges of the mainstream anti-violence movement, prisoner defense campaigns, women's prisons, multi-issue coalitions, and radical print culture. Indeed, the various organizing efforts and debates tracked in this book constitute important evidence that the process of state co-optation through liberal law and order was neither unchallenged by some activists, nor unwitting on the part of others. The terrain of feminist anti-violence organizing in the 1970s and early 1980s was experimental and conflicted, and the dialectical relationship between this organizing and the state not only yielded incorporative reforms, but also compelled emergent expressions of a prison abolitionist feminism. By homing in on this understudied current of late 20th century radical activism, this book contributes to the overlapping fields of carceral history and critical prison studies. To date, scholars have provided illuminating analyses of prison and jail rebellions, prison activist cultures, and the writings and cultural production of imprisoned radicals in the 1960s and 1970s. But very few of these studies focus on organizing and collective action inside and outside of women's prisons and jails. All Our Trials builds on these works, as well as on a growing scholarship that examines how gender and sexuality are entwined with race and class in the history of the modern carceral state. Placing feminist prison organizing at the center of historical analysis does more than recover examples of various women's participation in the radical prison movement of the 1970s. It invites a rethinking of the movement's allies and influences, strategies and targets, geography and durée. For instance, freedom campaigns for women of color, such as Desi Woods, drew together activists affiliated with a variety of movements and helped to make gender violence an arena of anti-carceral organizing. Similarly, the campaigns to oppose the construction of new maximum security behavior modification units for women prisoners that I explore in Chapter 2 took shape at the interface of feminist, psychiatric patients' liberation, and prison movements. Gender and sexual nonconforming, or queer feminist radicals, both white and of color, brought their personal encounters with psychiatric coercion to bear on their analyses of the prison system, impelling their demand for the end of all forms of caging. This study of anti-racist, queer feminist activism joins a vibrant scholarship that illuminates the diverse participants, contentious politics, and manifold fronts of struggle that define the so-called second wave of U.S. feminism. By centering the activism of women of color, working class and poor women, and queer and trans women, or by focusing on the politics of multiracial and cross-class coalitions and alliances, this body of work has demonstrated the, quote, messy multiplicity and broad horizons of feminism in the 1960s and 1970s. All Our Trials is particularly indebted to scholarship that emphasizes the permeable boundaries and interchanges among post-war liberation movements, either by recovering the itineraries of individual activists who traverse these movements and transform them in the process, or by zeroing in on particular local spaces, places, and coalitions in which the boundaries of feminism were constructed and contested. As it brings our attention to feminist organizing at the nexus of criminalization, imprisonment, and violence against women. It especially heeds historian A. Finn Anke's argument that, quote, feminism exceeded feminist identification. While numerous radical and progressive women of color and working class and poor women embraced and defined feminist identities for themselves in this period, many others eschewed this label because of the racism and class bias of white feminisms, or they opted to use other terms to express their gender politics. Hence, the genealogy of activism drawn in this book represents the efforts of self-described Black, Indigenous, Native American, Chicana, Latina, Asian American, socialist, and lesbian feminists, as well as people who were not identified with the moniker of feminism. All Our Trials traces the making of anti-carceral feminist politics by a translocal, loose collection of activists and groups that span the country. I have structured the book's chapters around particular forms or genres of collective action rather than around geographic locations or case studies. This arrangement brings into focus the development and circulation of ideas and organizing models and conveys the breadth and variety of people and groups that contributed to this feminist formation. I provide an analysis of particular groups and coalitional spaces, as well as trace conversations in activist print media that brought together people and organizations in different places. The publications I explore not only linked but transformed existing organizing efforts while catalyzing the emergence of others. As Maylee Blackwell argues in her study of 1970s Chicana feminism, quote, movement print culture functioned as a mediating space where new ideas, theories, and political claims were constructed, negotiated, and contested. Print culture was a particularly vital organizing forum for prison activists, as it enabled their ideas to breach carceral walls and help to form political communities that included many people who were not allowed to meet face-to-face. Researching the history of women prisoners organizing presents particular challenges. Since its archive is inherently evanescent, incarcerated women who led sit-down strikes and uprisings, drafted and circulated petitions, or smuggled uncensored mail in or out of the prison risked a range of punishments, including solitary confinement, transfer to a higher security prison, and denial of parole, as well as unofficial retribution by prison staff in the form of verbal and physical abuse and the destruction of their personal belongings. The threat and reality of reprisal effectively suppressed access to written records of the necessarily clandestine organizing done by dissident prisoners. The transient quality of much of this organizing and the inaccessibility of prison records renders the surviving archive even more opaque. At the same time, prisoner activism centers on piercing the isolation and invisibility that shields institutional authorities from scrutiny and accountability. As they do today, prison activists on both sides of the bars in the 1970s and 1980s turned to alternative media and created their own newspapers and newsletters to circulate information, confront dominant ideologies of crime and punishment, and participate in political communities that traverse institutional and local boundaries. The three chapters of this book that detail examples of inside-outside prison organizing analyze letters, communiques, and prose collected in underground and alternative media as an unauthorized archive of the political activities and ideas of incarcerated women. Writing a grassroots and translocal history of feminist radicalism presents difficulties that are inherent in documenting small groups that typically operated on shoestring or non-existent budgets that were sometimes short-lived. Concerns about state surveillance may have also prompted groups to encourage anonymous authorship and to avoid keeping records of their activities. Hence, the book draws on primary sources scattered across a wide array of state, university, community, and personal archives. These include organizational records and newsletters, activist ephemera and propaganda, personal correspondence, speeches, photographs, and mainstream and alternative newspapers. Ephemeral materials, such as leaflets, pamphlets, and posters.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?